Thank you, Bryce. Happy Sabbath, everyone. Well, it's with somewhat heavy heart that we gather this week, knowing that Mr. Zimmerman died this week. He was scheduled for the sermon today. And I was asked last week to be ready just in case he was unable to give the sermon. So we had opportunity to talk several times this last week, and I enjoyed that very much. And as I thought about him and the roles that he played this morning, I think of him as a minister. He was a pastor here for many years. He's a father, a grandfather, a father-in-law. He's a mentor and a guide, and as he would so nicely and kindly put it, a friend. And he even said, at one point when I called him recently and I said, as I have to many of you, and you've been here for conversations like this, I said, Mr. Z, can you help me perhaps improve my thinking about something? I'd like to share with you some thoughts and get your input on it. And you've all been there and for similar conversations like I say, and he said, it would be my pleasure as your friend to do that. So we're going to miss him. He was willing to give advice. Not everybody's willing to or is interested in enough to do it, but he was willing to put something out there. I think we might all remember recently how he could weigh in on important subjects. And at 12 minutes into a sermon of his one time, he said, just saying, it's been 12 minutes. This is the appropriate time to stop talking if you're giving a sermonette. And then he finished a relatively brief sermon, and he said, and as I finish, I'll say this is the appropriate time for a sermon. And he sat down. So he had no problem passing that on. He also had no problem passing on something that some of us aren't as comfortable with, and that is he would also pass on praise. He would say, you're doing a great job in this area. And he sort of had a way of doing something that reminds me of those of an Olympic sport I don't understand. I don't even know why it's an Olympic sport, but the curling, right? They throw the big thing down, and there's people up there sweeping in front of it, and they're making a nice smooth path for this thing, whatever it is, to go down the ice. And as I think about that, that's kind of what he would do for you, is he would tell you, you're on the right path, and let me smooth out the next little bit for you and encourage you to keep going. It was nice how he did that. And it cleared the path for the next level of growth. Mr. Z gave his life for something. I mean, he dedicated his entire life to what? Well, to us, right? And why? Why did he live a life of service? He did well. There was a time when he wasn't a full-time pastor, and he did well. He had a business, and he had real estate, and he did well. And then he went back to it. There was a need, and he felt like he was a man who could stand in that gap. And his wife supported that, and his family did, and sacrificed to some extent because he had to move away. Why did he do that? What was so important? Why did a man with dazzling intellect, to have a conversation and get into an intellectual conversation with Mr. Zimmerman was intimidating, because it wasn't long before this guy was way out of his depth. Yet he also knew how to have that and then encourage maybe the next step of education in whatever subject matter we were talking about. But why did he dedicate and devote so much time and attention to this body of knowledge that we come to study today? I'll ask this too. Why are you here? Why are we all here? I think I shared with you this coffee cup that my mom has in her cupboard. And she has a kind of fun to look in coffee cup cupboards, right? You see all this random collection sometimes. Some people have just like regular collection, but it's fun when they're just a bunch of random cups. And you look through there and try to pick out the one that you want, right? And this one that I found in her cupboard that I gravitate towards says, if God does not exist, nothing matters. And if God does exist, then nothing else matters. Which is it? What is the truth? We're here to study God's truth, and today the message is entitled Absolute Truth. Why do we even care about what's true? And are there multiple versions of the truth? It seems like there could be multiple versions of the truth. Everyone sort of has their own perception and version. And I happened to be in a group of business leaders not long ago in a conference room in a building that's very recognizable. And we're up on the fourth floor in this conference room. And the speaker got up and he said, "There is no such thing as absolute truth. There is only your perception of truth, and there is my perception of truth, and both could be true or neither could be true. It's our own constructs that we create as we take in information, and that becomes our truth. And as we discuss or try to come together when we need to, then we reconcile those truths and come to a new version, perhaps, of truth. But there is no such thing." Is that true? Could that be true? I mean, there could be a little truth to that, right? And we could both see the same thing, and we could perceive it differently. We could both be recounting the same story and recount it quite a bit differently. I had a buddy in college. We spent all 4 years together. And we had a lot of fun, made a lot of memories. And there are stories that come from those days. Fast forward 15 or 20 years, and I meet his nephew. And we were at winter family weekend, and we all had opportunity to go to a meal together. My buddy's brother, he wasn't there. But his brother was, and his nephew was. And they started saying, "Tell this story. Tell this story, tell that story," and encouraging these stories that they'd heard many times, and so they're hearing it from a different perspective. And at the end of the meal, this little guy, Davey, says, "You know, I have heard every one of those stories almost exactly like you told it, except when I heard it, it was my uncle that did all the cool stuff." Well, it's likely we both reconstructed the narrative a little bit, right? So the question is, which one was true? God gave us the capacity to think. He gave us the capacity to make plans and to proceed with those plans. At some point, as we think about our plans, as we think about what we want for ourselves in our lives, we start to think about, well, what does the future hold for us? What does it look like going forward? What happens after this death? What is this life all about? God gave us His truth to answer those questions. So it's the truth that we come to week after week, year after year, to study and learn more about. It's that truth that is the gospel. We've even heard that phrase, right? This is the gospel truth. What does that mean? What does that mean? What does it mean to us? Well, gospel means good news, right? So this is the truth about the good news. So if we understand that, if we believe that it is the absolute truth, then it's that truth that we come to understand, and it's that that causes us to want to align with our Creator and on His priorities. And it's interesting when someone perhaps we don't recognize walks through those doors. Wherever those doors may be, anywhere in the country or anywhere in the world, they'll walk through those doors, and we're known as a very warm church. And we may go and talk to them. And it's always awesome to have a conversation with them and to just listen. And they'll usually tell a story. And they'll tell a story about how they came to walk through those doors. And it's interesting to listen to that story, and there's one point I'm always hoping for and one point I'm always waiting for. And when this part of the story is told, it leaves me with hope that they'll walk through those doors again and again. And when their story goes something like this, Well, we were sitting here, and we were hearing things that just didn't quite seem right. And so we went looking, and then we went here, and we found that things just didn't sound exactly right. And so we went here, and here, and there, and here, and there, and everywhere. And we kept looking and looking for the truth. And that's that part of the story. We're looking for the truth. And we came across whatever it is, literature or a radio show or a person or an individual or someone we worked with. And I started hearing things that sounded a little weird, sounded a little different, sounded a lot different. Started looking into it, started reading it, started checking this out. And as weird as it is, it's in here. It's in here, and it seems true, and I hope that this continues, that what I hear here continues to correlate with what I read here, and that this is the truth. That conversation, when it ends like that, is extremely encouraging. It's exciting to see someone looking for the truth. Hopefully, that's what we're here for as well. Hopefully, it's that truth about the future that makes us want to change our lives, to come into alignment with what this book says, to come to understand it. Hopefully it's that truth that we want to share with others, because it's just boiling over. We see them and we think, oh, if only you could know and understand this. I'd like to at least try to set an example of it and then share it with you. It's that truth that Mr. Zimmerman cared so much about that he gave himself throughout the duration of his life to share with us. Mr. Miller in the announcements mentioned Beyond Today. We have a new Beyond Today magazine. And that magazine and its different versions have been an oracle for this good news, right? And it's been named different things over time. The plain truth. The plain truth. Not the complicated, not the twisted, not the obfuscated, not the cloudy truth, but the plain truth. And the good news. And the beyond today. And the vertical thought. Thinking not just horizontally at what we see here, but vertically toward our Creator. Absolute truth. Does it exist? Does it? Let's say yes. Let's go to John. John chapter 17. Let's read something pretty special. And why is John 17 special? We've talked about, or I've even last night had this conversation with a young man who just moved into the area, and I wasn't sure if he had given his first sermonette or not. And I've told him it's always a pleasure to hear a person's first sermonette, a man's first sermonette from behind this podium, because it's often on a subject that has been thought about for some time and really speaks to the core of that individual's thoughts. And many times we've gone to Matthew 5 and read the first words recorded in the Gospels that Christ spoke. And also, I'll say, now, I understand this a little bit more, and we're going to study this a bit today, that it's possible that a man's last message is also pretty important. And Mr. Zimmerman spoke on brotherly love. And one of the last things, in one of the last conversations we had just this week, he said, Scott, what we really need is love. That's what we need in God's church, is love. Truth and love, we might say. But he said, love. And that was his last message. And here we go to John. And what we're reading in John 17 is John, the apostle who Christ loved, recording some of the very last red letters here. And it's Christ's last prayer that's recorded in the Bible. And he says in John 17, 14, these are Christ's own words, "I have given them your word." This word, inspired by God. So he's saying, "I've given them your word." He's speaking to the Father. "And the world, those who don't understand this word, has hated them because they're not of the world, just as I am not of the world." He says, "I don't pray that you should take them out of the world." And so we're not out of the world. We live in it. We work in it. We operate in it, right? When we leave here, we come together here, and we come to charge our batteries and think about these truths, but we don't get that the rest of the week, do we? We go back out into the world, and this was Christ's prayer. They're in the world, but not of the world. "Just as I am not of the world, I do not pray that you should take them out of the world, but that you should keep them from the evil one." So he's praying that Satan be kept from influencing us. "They are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. Sanctify them. Set them apart. Make them holy or special to God by what? By your truth." And what is that truth? "Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I have also sent them into the world. And for their sakes, I sanctify myself that they may be sanctified or set apart by the truth." So yes, there is truth. There is absolute truth. And we have to believe that. We have to have faith to believe that, right? That these words are truth. Sometimes that may conflict with what we want to believe. Sometimes that may conflict with beliefs that we've held for some time. But that's something we're going to have to work with. And sometimes it can be extremely comforting as we study this. Let's turn over to 1 Thessalonians 4. Read something that's incredibly comforting in a time like this. 1 Thessalonians chapter 4. Thessalonians 4:13 says, "I don't want you to be ignorant, brethren." Brothers and sisters, those who have come here to learn the truth. "I don't want you to be ignorant." In other words, I don't want you to lack knowledge. I don't want you to not know the truth about this subject. "Concerning those who have fallen asleep, lest you sorrow as others who have no hope. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so God will bring with him those who sleep in Jesus." So then he talks about the resurrection and the fact that we'll live again. Verse 18, "Therefore comfort one another with these words." It's been commented on many times at a funeral by those who may not be a part of this body of knowledge. They come to a funeral and they witness the demeanor of everyone. And they say, it's a little strange, actually. This doesn't feel as heavy and sad as some funerals do. And it's perhaps because everyone understands that there's comfort and that there is a future. There can be very sad circumstances for funerals, there's no doubt about that. And for different reasons, they have different levels of gravity. Yet, there's also extreme comfort knowing that there will be a reunion. And there will be the opportunity again to discuss the truths and to really deeply understand them. And how exciting that is. Let's turn over to 1 Corinthians 15. Read some more encouraging words on this subject. 1 Corinthians 15, in verse 12, it says, Christ is preached that he has been raised from the dead. And he's saying, how does some of you say that there is no resurrection of the dead? That would be an untruth. That if those that heard this lie, we'll just call it what it is, at a minimum, a lack of understanding, but a non-truth is still a lie, especially if they understood, it would be extremely disruptive to an individual's walk. Now, how do some among you say there is no resurrection of the dead? If there's no resurrection of the dead, then Christ is not risen. If Christ is not risen, then our preaching is empty and your faith is empty. All of this is for nothing, is what he's saying. That's significant. Yes, and we are found false witnesses of God. That means that anybody who's preaching the truth would be really a liar. So there's this conflict here. Because we've testified of God that he raised up Christ, whom he did not raise up. In fact, if the dead do not rise, then Christ is not risen. Your faith is futile and you're still in your sins. And then he gets to verse 19, though. And he delivers a powerful part of this message. He says, if in this life only we have hope in Christ, we are of all men most pitiable. Knowledge of God's truth makes our life better. No question about it. Understanding God's plan is better. It gives us peace knowing that the circumstances, the trials, the challenges that we face in life are all for a purpose. Yet, it's important to understand that this walk of life, knowing God's truth, is not always better. It's not always easier. God didn't say, I'm going to come and make your life easier. He said, ultimately, it's going to work out for the good. You're going to learn lessons. You're going to be instructed. The sermonette today talked about the fact that we'll be corrected. We'll be chastened. As a father corrects their son. Right? And daughters. That's part of the process. If God's going to invite us into his family, it only makes sense that he's going to treat us as family. And as a father treats his family, there's going to be a discussion when something's out of line. It's like, that's not the standard. That's not to the standard. We have to work on that. And God works with us through people and circumstances and education, and that's not always easier. And so if we want an easy life, we can try to avoid all problems. We can try to do things different. When we walk this way of life, we're accepting and submitting to God and his authority. And he may take our path in a way that we hadn't anticipated. And he may cause circumstances and events that feel really unpleasant. Said that in Hebrews 12. No chastening is pleasant. It's painful. It can be painful. Those exact words are in Hebrews 12. Painful. Yet, we see that it works for the good, ultimately. That's kind of what we're signing up for. But if it was only for this life, if that's the only reason we were going through these lessons and learning these things and being worked with and corrected, saying here, that would be horrible. It's for the future that we go through this. Not just our future, but all of those who God will raise and call and give us the opportunity to influence because we've been through it. We won't say to them, ooh, that's rough. You know, I just don't understand what you're going through. I never felt any of that. Everything was great for me my whole life. Maybe we can get someone else to help you or something because I don't really understand. That won't be the conversation because we'll say, yeah, I've been there. We've been there. Felt that. That hurt. in Hebrews 4. It says we don't, 4:15, I think it is. Clearly I'm off script a little bit. But Hebrews 4:15 says, we have a high priest who can sympathize with us. We do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are without sin, yet without sin. Because he's been where we are, he's felt what we feel. And we can go before the throne and understand that we have an intercessor who understands. He's felt betrayal. He's felt the pain. He was tempted. Satan himself tempted Christ. He's felt disappointment. He's felt discouragement. He's felt excitement and elation as well. He's been through the whole spectrum of emotions and understands. And we will too. We'll have been through it. And we'll know the truth. So, understanding these truths is core to our entire being and motivation in life. It's for that reason that we want to be transformed into that image of God. And Satan is the adversary to that plan. He wants to knock us all off the path. He wants to win. Or score as many points as he can, you might say, in the time that he has left. And the only way he can do that, because he knows in the end that he doesn't win ultimately, is to take as many of us as he can with him. And he's really good at it. And he is intent, he's motivated, he's focused, and he's persistent. And he's going to get us all any way he can at any phase of life. Until our last breath, he's on the job. And how does he do it? What's his MO? What's his game plan? How does he operate? Well, it doesn't take us long to find out in the book. That character is introduced, chapter 3, verse 1. Right? Barely is the creation finished. The account of the creation finished. When Satan enters the scene with the first two people, and what does he start to do? He starts with twisting the truth. Starts with saying, what is it you understand? Oh yeah, that's not exactly right. Who told you that? Well, God did. Oh yeah, of course he did. He'd tell you that. He doesn't want you to know the truth. Well, what is the truth? Oh, this is good for you. No, we'll die if we eat that. Not exactly. And you see how that works? Starts playing with their minds, and they bought it. So what does that mean for you? Are you just off to college? Are you reading new books? Are you meeting new teachers? Are you being taught new things? Is your mind open to new knowledge as it's coming in? What a great time for the adversary to be there. Or how about studying biology or science, maybe in junior high, and what a great time for there to inject a little doubt. That just even saying the term, this has evolved into this. A trusted advisor's up there teaching. Yeah, this has evolved this way. Just even using that terminology injects a little doubt. Well, wait a minute. He means created. So you translate in your own mind for a while until pretty soon you start to get a little cloudy there, right? So, we have to be careful of that. 1 John 5:19 says, we know that we are of God. Just as Christ prayed for his people, to set them apart. So, if we're those people, we know that we are of God, and the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. That is also a truth. The truth is that the whole world lies under the sway of Satan. Well, that helps. If we understand that truth, then it helps. We know that they're under the sway, so there could be spin on it. That's one way to put it, right? Spin. There's something not quite right about it. And we know that the Son of God has come and given us an understanding so that we may know Him, God the Father, who is true. And we are in Him who is true, in His Son, Jesus Christ. We can know that. And that's pretty awesome to know. When we have these challenges to our values and our core beliefs. And it can be tough. And again, back to those life circumstances. Those life circumstances that can rock our world and inject doubt. How can I have prayed for a different outcome and yet this still happened? Did God not hear my prayer? Is there really a God? Does He even care? Can those thoughts enter our mind? Of course they can. Who's real happy about that? The adversary is. God says, no, I'm still with you. And I know this is tough. And I know this doesn't make sense. And yet, God's still there. He's still in it. And He's still working with us. And He still wants what's best for us. Yet those times can be really, really tough. There can be other times where maybe it's less emotional, more intellectual. The thinkers out there think about how did this come about and could this be true and is this true or is this false? Maybe it's a little more binary, less on a spectrum, more binary. True, false. False. Why false? Because it doesn't make sense. Because I can't see it, because I can't prove it. Because science is testing whether what we know is true or not. Right? And I can't prove it. So I have to keep it in the false column until I can prove that it's absolutely true in my mind as a thinker. Perhaps that's the way your mind works. And so that's tough. And then there are these pervasive ideas that are propagated through multiple media, through the education channels. And now more than ever, anyone's opinion can be broadcast and consumed very easily. And anyone can become an expert or can insert doubt into an otherwise logical train of thought. So we have mistruths, half-truths, opinions. We have terms that may or may not make total sense, like moral relativism. What is moral relativism? That sounds interesting. Might want to know more about it. How about the view that there are no universal moral rules? Now, that's interesting because almost universally we agree what's good or bad, what's right or wrong. How do we get that? Where does that come from? Is it wrong to kill someone? Most every society agrees that it is. Is it wrong to lie? Is it wrong to do something? Almost everyone will be a little shocked with certain actions and behaviors that are considered right or wrong. Well, where did that definition come from? How about other terms? Situational ethics. What is situational ethics? Well, it means the situation kind of determines what's right or wrong, what's winning or losing. So, rules are dependent upon the traditions and convictions of a particular group of people. So it could be right, could be wrong. Well, ultimately we come to this question, what happens after death? So we go through all these different philosophies about life now. Well, what about after death? We could explore hundreds and thousands of theories, ideas, hypotheses, firmly held beliefs, convictions, ideologies, speculations, hopes and dreams, whatever we may label it, right? Whatever a person's perspective is. In the sermonette, we heard some song lyrics of a group trying to figure it out. And they have their ideas and they want to propagate that in a nice message, in a good-sounding message. And who knows if they understand or not. It sounds good, and it could be very much in alignment with what we read. God told us in His Word, outlining His truth, because He doesn't want there to be doubts. He wants us to understand. And He wants us to understand what His definition of good is, His definition of evil. We're warned or cautioned by Isaiah in Isaiah 5. Not only are we warned and cautioned, but so are those who would propagate ideas that are false. And this was a situation that has been prevalent, as we read, since Genesis 3. Started in the very beginning with the first two people. It went all through, and it's true now that Satan's out there injecting doubt, twisting the truth. And Isaiah was addressing this issue in Isaiah 5 and verse 20. He says, "Woe to those who call evil good and good evil, who put darkness for light and light for darkness, bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter." Woe to those who change that around. That's not right. That's what Satan does. He's the father of lies. And that's not good. And does it take a level of humility? Does it take submission to look to God's word and say, I'm going to read this and believe that our Creator is telling us something here, and I'm going to defer to what I read, not what I think? Does it take humility for that? It does, and it says here in verse 21, Isaiah says, "Woe to those who are wise in their own eyes and prudent in their own sight." That sounds kind of like a dad's correction, right? It's wonderful that you know everything, son. It's great to be that smart. But just consider that perhaps you might not have the broadest perspective. That's one way to put it. But the point is that we have to be careful of that. God hates what's not true. If we turn over to 1 John, in the New Testament, we read John writing to his church and warning them and encouraging them. And he says in 1 John 2:3, "Now by this we know him, if we keep his commandments. He who says, 'I know him,' and doesn't keep his commandments is a liar, and the truth is not in him." So it's possible that we're going to hear lies. That was what was being said here. There are lies out there, and it's not in the truth. "But whoever keeps his word, truly the love of God is perfected in him." And then he says, "Walk as I walked," and he goes through different elements. Know that there are counterfeits out there. There are counterfeits out there. And we have to be careful of those. Examples of those counterfeits. How about holidays versus holy days? Right? We're headed into the holiday season. Interesting, because we just finished a holy day season, and now we're headed into the holidays. So there can be some good holidays. I think we all love Thanksgiving. I was talking to my aunt this week, and she talked about Thanksgiving and how important that is for our family. And something I hadn't thought of is that we all agree on Thanksgiving. So in our family, whether we're part of this body of knowledge or not, everyone agrees that Thanksgiving is a great holiday because we're pointing to God. We're looking to God and being thankful for what He's given us. And it's a great time to get together as family, and it was always reserved for family. And I hadn't thought about the fact that that's why that day is so special. It's one that everyone agrees on. And it's a great time to get together. So we know that that's a counterfeit. Sabbath and Sunday. speaking of song lyrics, somebody was saying that the song was referring to the Sabbath, but it was referring to Sunday. How about another little mistruth? The law was nailed to the cross. Now, is that true or not? What, there was something nailed to the cross, but what was nailed to the cross? Yeah, it was the indictment against all of us that would be true. And it, because we've broken the law. So it's that which is nailed to the cross, is this indictment that we would be guilty of. And yet Christ paid the penalty for that. So that's done away, but not the law. The law isn't done away. So there's a little mistruth there. What a blessing it is to know the truth. What a blessing it is to know that even as society changes, and it does, and it's a repetitive and recurring pattern in societies, but it also continues to change and evolve, you might say. That is something that evolves. We can know that Jesus Christ is the same. Hebrews 13:8. Hebrews 13:8 says, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. Verse 9, do not be carried about with various and strange doctrines, for it is good. And then he goes into a specific issue that he was dealing with in that church, the author is. So Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today, forever. We can think about that and know that there is absolute truth that does not change. The Bible is infallible, and its author is infallible. We had opportunity this year before the feast in Snowshoe, West Virginia, a nice, very nice, beautiful town in the mountains. Interestingly enough, cell phones don't really work in Snowshoe, West Virginia. I did not know that there were places in the world that were still like that. They didn't work. We didn't talk on the phone for 8 days. I didn't even miss it. That thing was a camera for 8 days. And the occasional text that would come in like several hours later or something. But so anyway, before we went into those hills, we went to Washington, D.C. And in Washington, D.C., there's a new museum that was recently built, the Museum of the Bible. And the Museum of the Bible has gathered information and truths. And it's a sort of a data-driven exploration of the Bible. They want to present the facts to all who might want to come see. One of the most technologically advanced and engaging museums in the world is the Bible Museum. This is from their website, offering an immersive experience with the Bible and its ongoing impact on the world around us. Historical truths and artifacts confirm the biblical narrative. The Bible has never been proved wrong. Now, there's a lot of effort to try to find some incongruency there, and yet it has never been proven wrong. There can be misunderstandings, mistranslations, yet there's nothing that proves it wrong, which is pretty amazing considering that 35 authors wrote 66 books over thousands of years, many of them predicting future events hundreds of years ahead of time by name. Isaiah writes about Cyrus 400 years before Cyrus was born, and he writes that God is calling the king of Persia 400 years from now by name and saying exactly what he was going to do, and he did in Ezra 1:1. You can read about it. How does that happen? Who could do that? And God says, oh, only me. Only God can. Only God can tell the end from the beginning and declare things that are as facts before they ever happen. And he does. And we've talked about the fact that the Bible is approximately one-third prophecy, and only one-third of that has been fulfilled. So we've got more than a fifth of this book that is yet to happen. And it will happen. So it was interesting to go through the Museum of the Bible and see these different time eras. The Egyptian era and how all of the information that they have around the Egyptian era correlates exactly with the biblical narrative. The Rosetta Stone, or a replica of the Rosetta Stone, was in the museum there. And the significance of the Rosetta Stone is it had the same story told three times. The same narrative was told in Egyptian hieroglyphics, in Egyptian, and I believe it's in Hebrew as well. And because of that, now it's the decoder stone, so that it was now possible to decode all of the Egyptian hieroglyphics and the Egyptian writings and be able to translate it. So now that opened up a whole new element of history, which all, again, correlates well with the narrative. You go from Egyptian, you go to Assyrian, Babylonian, you go to Greeks, you go to the Persians, you go to the Romans, and as you move through that history, you can go, and Colin went through Western Civ last year, and it was pretty interesting to go through his book on Western civilization and then go through the whole timeline. We have this book has the timeline and the history of the Bible, and it goes from creation on, and it's this fold-out book that probably goes from here to the third row. And so we spread it all out on the counter, and you can just flip through the pages of Western Civ and just kind of move along that timeline. And it all correlates really well, because it's all true. It's true. It's been recorded accurately. Now, does that mean that thought leadership and synthesis of ideas doesn't exist and there's not some value or nutrition in that? The Greeks had really deep thoughts, right? And when there have been peaceful times and civilization, it has enabled knowledge to grow, because there's been time for exploration and time for thoughts to mature and multiple generations to educate other generations, and so that knowledge can build on each other. So there can be great things. There can be philosophers. Even today, the knowledge is exploding, because we have access to more knowledge than we ever did before, at our fingertips on specific subjects, quickly accessible, well indexed. That didn't exist before this generation. So you can build rapidly upon any body of knowledge, and so it's growing quickly. That can be a good thing. And there are academics and intellectuals that can have some great truths and some great ideas and some valuable insights. So it's not to discount everything. It's important that we understand that. It's just that we have to be careful. We have to compare it to what is absolutely true. How many of you know a thing or two about cash money? Cash money? Anybody ever seen a dollar? Dollar bill? You know it pretty well. Could you recognize if something looked like a dollar but wasn't a dollar? How many times does the number one appear on a dollar in written or numerical form? Or even Roman numeral form? How many times would you say? How many would say, well, just somebody throw out a number. 8? Who said 8? 12? So let's go 12 or under. Raise your hand. Okay, so let's go 12 or over. How about 15 times? Sticking with us? How about 20 times? Think it could have the number one on there 20 times? I took this dollar out of my wife's wallet. It's just any dollar. It's not exceptional in that it doesn't have any ones in the serial numbers, and it appears to have the number one on it about 22 times. Well done. And 22 times, it seems to be about the average. I've got one that has some in the serial numbers and has 11s here, and it has it like 32 times, which is pretty surprising. So all of you know a thing or two about cash money. And do you know anything about the paper that this is printed on? Who knows about the paper that this is printed on? It's not really paper. Oh, you know that. It's linen. It's a blend of cotton and linen. It's pretty robust. That's why you can launder money and it doesn't just turn into mush. So we've got this dollar, and now we're learning a few things about it. You see this little letter in here? Can you see that, Mr. Jeff? Those are some gray glasses. That, and they look great on you, by the way. This is the number 12, and L in this little circle. If you're ever looking for a counterfeit, just check this right away. If that number is and this letter don't correlate, and that L is the 12th letter of the alphabet, then immediately you know it's counterfeit. Did you know that? So that's a fact, as Kaylee used to say, a true fact. It's a fact about the dollar. Now, I could tell you lots of facts about the dollar, and then we could start to speculate. There's a little pyramid on here with an eye. What does that eyeball mean? Is that the Illuminati? There's an eagle here with 13 arrows in one tail end and 13 tail feathers, 13 stripes, 13 stars, 13. What does all that mean? And what's the significance of it? And one wing has one less feather than the other. And we could just go crazy, right? I could tell you all kinds of things about the dollar as if they were true facts, and we would be getting way off into speculation. How would you ever know if it's true or not? Would you go and study all of these theories? If you were to try to identify a counterfeit, would you go and study all the great counterfeits so that you'd be able to recognize them? How many of you think that would be a good idea? Study all the counterfeits. How many of you know that those who are tasked with identifying counterfeits study the original? And they really get to know the original. They know everything about the original. And they learn everything about the original. They study it in incredible detail. And then they recognize anything that is not original and know it to be a counterfeit. Thanks, honey. So, is that what we can do with God's truth? Is that what we're tasked with when we dive into the Word? Is to read it and to really know the original? And to study the original so that we know it so well that when anyone tells us something that isn't in there, we recognize it. That's what truth is all about. There's craftiness with the Word. Let's turn to 2 Corinthians 4. Therefore, since, starting in verse 1, since we have this ministry, this service, that we have received mercy, we do not lose heart, but we've renounced the hidden things of shame, not walking in craftiness, nor handling the word of God deceitfully, but by manifestation of the truth, we've commended ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. And even if our gospel is veiled, if it's not understood by everyone, it's veiled to those who are perishing, whose mind the God, little g, of this age has blinded. So there's a lot going on in this little passage. It's saying that they are handling the truth and that not everyone understands it because they've been blinded by Satan. And that there are some that don't believe, lest the light of the gospel or the good news of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine on them. So the light is an illumination. It's enabling one to see what they couldn't see before. And like any of us who have gotten glasses at some point, whether we thought we needed them or not, all of a sudden we say, whoa, I can see a whole lot better. There's leaves on those trees. There's words on those green blurry signs. I can tell what light is lit up when I'm driving through that intersection. Hopefully you got glasses before, you couldn't tell that. But you can see again, and you didn't know what you couldn't see before, right? It's surprising the things you weren't able to see. Sometimes I think, I wonder if glasses would help this. Oh yeah, it helps that. You can see a whole lot better. You can read a whole lot easier. So there is this veiling, and the gospel is the light. John 8:32, giving us some references to think about this truth. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. And the verse right before that says, if you abide in my word, you're my disciples indeed. So by abiding in the word, we know the truth. And we become disciples. Are you disciples? Oh, that sounds like a hefty title. Disciples? You are disciples. This is what it's saying. If you study the word, you are a disciple. You are a student of the word. And that word is so important. And when you study that word, then you're studying the truth, and that truth opens your mind and lets you see perhaps what you didn't see before, and that gives you freedom. What a wonderful truth that is. We read in John 17, set them apart, Christ's prayer, by your truth, and your word is truth. We'll conclude, and we'll turn to 1 Corinthians 2. And we'll understand why this gets so cloudy. And it is important to understand why this gets so cloudy. 1 Corinthians 2, in verse 6, we're speaking wisdom among those who are mature or who are maturing. Yet not the wisdom of this age, nor the rulers of this age. We mentioned that there are powerful intellectuals and academics, great thinkers, that really have some great insights and who would discount all of this as myth, fantasy, stories. Perhaps true, but not necessarily important. And certainly the constructs of this word aren't true or false or necessary to shape your life around or within. They just wouldn't get it. It says, we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, the hidden wisdom of God ordained before the ages for our glory, which none of the rulers of this age knew, for had they known, they wouldn't have crucified the Lord of glory. As it is written, eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor has entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him, for those who prioritize him. But God has revealed them to us through his Spirit. The Spirit searches all things. And what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of man which is in him? So we all understand the things of man because we have the spirit of man. We've talked about this many times, that animals just don't get that. They just operate on instinct. It's very different. Smart as some can be. Even so, no one knows the things of God except the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the Spirit of the world, but the Spirit who is from God, that we might know the things that have been freely given to us by God. God shares them with us. It's the good news. It's the plain truth. It's the facts about something beyond today. These things we speak, verse 13, not in words which man's wisdom teaches, but which the Holy Spirit teaches, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. But the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, nor can he know them because they're spiritually discerned. Does that help? Does that help it to make sense why people who we would determine and discern and see clearly, they're very intelligent. We could say these are some of the smartest, most perhaps emotionally intelligent people we know. And by comparison, I look like an idiot. How is it that I would know these things and they wouldn't? Surely something is wrong here. How can I understand this? Well, probably the truth is I don't. Not perfectly, but I can read it. I can try to understand it. I can ask for help and guidance and come and be taught and teach as I've been taught and really try to learn it to teach it and continue to learn as a student, as a disciple, that's what we do. And we come to a greater and greater knowledge that layers on every day and every week and every Sabbath and every holy day, true holy day season, we learn more. It layers on. Plenty of data to support the notion that education is best delivered layer by layer, and that cramming is less successful. It goes into the short-term memory and is gone. Remember that, kids, as you study. Young people, I should say. Prepare for tests. Study all semester. Layer it on, small layers, and it becomes more part of your long-term memory. God knows that. He created our minds. So does it make sense that He gave us these holy days every year to layer it on? And the Sabbath every week to come together and refresh our memory? Of course it does. But this wisdom isn't freely available. And why did He choose us as a group of people? We'll have to ask Him. He's got a good sense of humor. Right? I don't know. But we know, we read, that it's not freely available. So it takes God's Spirit to discern. So we have the mind of Christ. Christ and God have shared their truths with us, and what a wonderful blessing it is to know that. How awesome it is to know that. It was that truth that Mr. Zimmerman really wanted us to know and understand. And Mr. Remy finished with a scripture, or a reference to scripture. It's pretty awesome. In Luke 10, verse 23 and 24, it says, "Blessed are you to know these things which we have heard and the things which you see," which are the absolute truth.